The Tom Woods Show, episode 966.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, you were a victim of educational malpractice when you were in school. Well, learn the history and economics they didn't teach you at mylibertyclassroom.com. And save yourself some smackers by checking out my coupon page, libertyclassroom.com/coupons. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Here's what I'm going to do for this episode. We're going to start off listening to a speech, an excellent common sense speech, delivered by Jeff Deist at the Corax Conference in Malta over the weekend. We had one of the organizers of that event on the show a number of episodes ago, Martin Erickson. We had a very good conversation with him about libertarianism in Europe. So we're going to play Jeff's speech. I'm not going to give any commentary right now. I just want you to listen to the speech. I want to hear what's a normal person's reaction to the speech, not an emotional hypochondriac. What's a normal person's reaction to the speech? Because my audience is full of normal people. A whole bunch of them. A whole bunch of normal people listen to my show. And I'd like to know your thoughts about the Jeff Deist speech. So here we go. And then when it's over, I'm going to add some commentary about how crazed hysterics responded to this speech. And by the way, when I listened to it at the time, and I was talking to people who were in Malta when it was delivered, he delivered it via Skype because he was in Auburn for the Mises University, where, you know, where they teach Austrian economics. And he delivered it to the audience at the Mises Institute while also broadcasting it to Malta. So that's what's going on here. I'm not going to include the Q&A session just because I want to just stick to the speech, but if you'd like to hear the Q&A session, I'll link to the whole thing at tomwoods.com/966. So here we go.
As the title of my talk suggests, what I'd like to talk about this afternoon for us, this evening for you, is not libertarianism per se or so much, but libertarians themselves. And I'd like to ask you all to consider whether libertarians perhaps have lost their way. I'm very happy that you've managed to get Dr. Hans Hermann Hoppe at your conference. Several of his colleagues are here with us this week, people he's known and worked with over the years, people like Lou Rockwell and Dr. Joe Salerno and Tom DiLorenzo and Tom Woods and Mark Thornton and lots of other people. So it's great that we're able to sort of cross-pollinate and give a big round of applause and a hello to Dr. Hoppe to begin. Well, obviously, the title for New Libertarian, I hope you all recognize as a play on words, the title of Murray Rothbard's book, For New Liberty, written in the 1970s. The Libertarian Manifesto. In some ways, I think it's actually less well-known or less talked about than The Ethics of Liberty, even though it preceded it by about 8 or 10 years. And his subtitle is The Libertarian Manifesto. You know, a lot of authors have the gall to call their book a manifesto, but few authors actually live up to such a bold subtitle, and this book does live up to it. And there's a great line from Murray, not actually in this book, where he says, libertarianism then is a philosophy seeking a policy. And I wonder if he could be with us today, if he might change that line, given what we've seen the so-called public policy branch of libertarianism has become. Or maybe we might even rewrite the lines for ourselves and say, libertarianism is a philosophy looking for better libertarians, because I think that's where we might be today. And I also chose the title because I want to make the very important point that we don't need a new libertarianism or anything so grand. Thanks to all the great thinkers before us and some of them who are still among us, you and I don't have to do the hard work, which is good news because not many of us are really smart enough to come up with new theory on our own. So we all serve, I think, very happily as secondhand dealers in ideas, as Hayek termed it. But there is a tendency amongst liberty-minded people to fall into this trap of needing something new. We might even call it a modernity trap. It's become trendy almost to imagine that technology is going to create a new paradigm for us and that there's going to be a third way that will make government and the state obsolete without any sort of intellectual shift amongst the people. The digital age is so flat and it's so democratic and so highly decentralized that it's going to prove impossible for these top-down hierarchical states to continue to control us. And the free flow of information around the world is going to make it harder for tyrants to remain unmasked, because people are going to talk to each other across borders, and they're certainly doing so. And while I hope all this is true, I'm just not so sure it is. It seems to me that status are actually shifting from national to supranational models, that globalism, in effect, means more centralized control by this emerging cartel of superstates like the EU and NGOs and organizations like the IMF and the UN. And not to mention, there's actually been calls for a convergence of a single central bank for the entire world under the auspices of the IMF. So I think, as much as we might like to think that way, we ought to be suspicious that there's some sort of deterministic arc that inevitably bodes well for liberty to human history. If we look at human history, sometimes things go sideways for quite a while, and sometimes they even go backwards. So it's up to us to make sure that they proceed. And while we all benefit from and marvel at the technologies that are available to us, and we especially welcome technologies that make it harder for the state to govern us, like Bitcoin or Uber or encryption and these sorts of things, we also have to remember that advances in technology make it easier for government to spy on us, to control us, to imprison us, to tax us, to regulate us, in some instances, even to kill us. So technology is always a double-edged sword from a libertarian perspective of our relationship with the state. So I suspect that humans are going to continue to exhibit this stubborn tendency to form governments. And the choice between organizing human affairs by economic means or political means won't be undone so easily. It wasn't undone by the printing press. It wasn't undone by the Industrial Revolution. It wasn't undone by electricity or any number of enormous technological advancements in the 20th century. So we can't assume liberation will come to us simply through the digital revolution. I think it's going to take more than that. So with that in mind, I would say Murray Rothbard's old-fashioned conception of liberty, almost 50 years old now, has really held up quite well over that half century. The idea that humans are sovereign over their minds and bodies, which means you own yourself. And from that, we have a corollary that flows, meaning property rights. Individuals have a valid claim to the byproducts of their minds and bodies. And axiomatically, we know that humans have to act just to survive, so they need property, they need sustenance. And from self-ownership and property rights, we arrive at a theory of when and where force is permissible, namely in self-defense, in the Rothbardian conception. And we apply these ideas to everyone, regardless of whether they band together in a group and call themselves government. So since governments necessarily use aggression and force in ways other than self-defense, and under the Rothbardian formulation, they're inherently invalid. So I'm sure most people in both of these rooms today are pretty familiar with this Rothbardian theory. And it's a beautiful and simple and logical theory. And elements of all three, at least a degree of all three, meaning individual liberty, property rights, and some conception of law that protects the first two, are really necessary for all human progress. I know we can look back and we can say, well, gee whiz, Jeff, slaves built the pyramids, although Egyptologists increasingly tell us that's not true. And we can look back and say, well, Soviet scientists who were hardly free, they built nuclear weapons. But that was probably to avoid a trip to Siberia. The larger point we know is that liberty and human progress are inextricably linked. And I don't think anyone in this room would argue that. So we have this fantastic, airtight Rothbardian theory of liberty. But it turns out it's not enough. And Murray himself acknowledged this both at the end of For New Liberty and at the end of The Ethics of Liberty. Both books would contain a section on strategy at the end. And he was really the first to stress the importance of people and activism, not just ideas and education. But what kind of people and what kind of activism? That's the question that he labored under, and it's still the question today, I think. So I'd like to offer a few suggestions and ideas about libertarians and what libertarians ought to do to move us closer to Murray's vision. And I think one of the most important things we can do to better sell or promote liberty is to make the overriding point that liberty is natural and organic, and it comports with human action. It doesn't require a new man. Libertarians have this bad tendency of falling into utopianism, into portraying liberty as something new and evolved. And in this way, we tend to sound a lot like progressives. Liberty will start to work when humans finally shed their old ideas about family and tribe and become purely rationalistic free thinkers, a term I hate. It always means the opposite. Have you noticed this? Free thinker is never a good thing in my experience. But when we become purely rational free thinkers and reject all this mythology of religion and faith, and when we start to give up our outdated ethnic or nationalist or cultural alliances, it will accept the new hyper-individualist creed. We need to drop all the old-fashioned bourgeois sexual hang-ups, bourgeois values, family structures. But the one thing we can never drop, of course, is materialism, good old-fashioned materialism, because above all, the libertarian archetype is always presented as this kind of soulless economic actor, someone who would drop everything and move to Singapore tomorrow if it means making $20,000 more a year in the new gig economy. Well, the problem is, it turns out that's not how humans really are. They're actually fragile and fallible and hierarchical and irrational and suspicious and herd-like, at least as much as they're these noble and heroic Hank Reardons. In fact, you know, Murray talks about this at the end of For the New Liberty. He reminds us that it's progressive utopians who claim that man has no nature and that he's infinitely malleable, as Murray says. They think man can be perfected and made into this ideal servant of the new order. But, he points out, libertarians claim to believe in free will, which means people mold themselves. And therefore, it's folly to expect some sort of drastic change in man's nature to fit our preferred structure. Now, we certainly hope people will act morally, and we believe that a more libertarian world creates the right incentives for moral improvement, but we don't rely on this to make liberty work. In fact, Murray makes the profound point that libertarianism is the only system that accepts humans as they are, right here, right now. And in this sense, he says, it's the only theory that's eminently realistic, the only theory that is really consistent with the nature of man and the world. But we don't seem to sell it that way. So let's understand what Murray's talking about and promote liberty as a deeply pragmatic approach to organizing society, one that solves problems and conflicts just by muddling through with the best available private voluntary solutions to any issue or problem or conflict. Let's reject these grand visions and utopias for what's always going to be a messy and imperfect world. And I think that's really ought to be our motto, better not perfect, when it comes to talking about libertarianism. Because how many of us have been in this situation where someone asks us, well, what's a libertarian answer to X, Y, and Z? And of course, the current scenario is highly imperfect. Human beings are highly imperfect. Markets are just a manifestation of that imperfection. But yet we're always attempting to respond with some perfect, airtight answer. It's not the way the world works. Better not perfect. So in addition to portraying libertarianism as something more natural and organic that comports with our nature, I think we make a huge mistake when we fail to embrace the institutions of civil society. And I think this is something that's been a nagging part of libertarianism really since its modern incarnation in the 1960s and 70s. So civil society itself, let's think about that for a second. You know, libertarians enthusiastically embrace markets, but for decades we've made this disastrous mistake of appearing hostile to family, to tradition, to religion, to culture, to civic and social institutions. In other words, hostile to civil society itself, which is bizarre if we think about it, because civil society provides the very mechanisms we need to organize society without the state. And in keeping with Rothbard's point about liberty and human nature, civil society organizes itself organically without force. That's the definition of civil society. It stands apart from pure markets and the state. Human beings want to be part of something larger than themselves. And why do we fail to grasp this decade after decade? And one thing that's bigger than ourselves for many of us is family. Some of you in Malta may not be familiar. I bet a lot of people in this room are. There was a famous Republican politician named Haley Barbour. And he was for a long time governor of the state of Mississippi. He was also the longtime chairman of the Republican National Committee. I saw him on C-SPAN one time. And he said something profound, although he didn't know it was profound. This guy, for those of you in Malta, this guy's the archetype of a Southern Republican, big, beefy, red guy. And so he said something along the lines of, you know, down here in the South, we know where our grandparents are buried. And what he meant was people in the South have a greater connection to their family and to their tradition and to the land and to their own histories. A history, I might add, which is apart from the state. When was the last time you ever heard a libertarian say anything quite like that? It scarcely needs to be said that family has always been the first line of defense and the most important source of primary loyalty or divided loyalty from the perspective of politicians who don't much like family structures. You know, our connection with our ancestors and our concern for our progeny form a story. These two things form a story in which the state is not the main character. The state's not even in the story. So family also forms our earliest and hence our most formative environment. And at least as an ideal, we all hope for this, family provides both material and emotional support. So happy families actually exist. It's not a myth. But government wants us atomized, lonely, broke, vulnerable, dependent, despondent, and especially disconnected. So of course it attempts to break up families by taking kids away from them as early as possible, indoctrinating them in state schools, using welfare as a wedge, using the tax code as a wedge, discouraging marriage and large families. In fact, really discouraging any kind of intimacy that is not subject to public scrutiny, encouraging divorce, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this may all sound like right-wing talking points, but that doesn't mean it's not true. We want strong families. We want elite families. We want wealthy families that are not afraid of the government. We want large extended families that people can turn to in times of trouble. One example, of a strong family, look at Mark Cuban and his family. When the SEC went after him for a BS insider trading allegation, most of us, you know, without his elite status and money, would have just rolled over and tried to settle it. We would have been too afraid, but he cared about his reputation. He had the money to fight back, and he fought back and he won. And let me just make a practical side note. This is especially for all of you 20 and 30-somethings who are going to start to shift in your seats and get uncomfortable. If we assume that roughly 10% of the U.S. population is fairly amenable to libertarian views, that's 32 million people. Now imagine if each of those 32 million people had three kids. Okay, that's an army of 100 million people right there, just for starters. And I'm told that Malta has a few Catholics as well, so maybe they can help with this. And on the subject of Catholics, I'd like to continue from the family. Look, religion forms another important line of defense against the state. Really, the whole history of man can't be understood without understanding religion. Even today, a healthy percentage of people in the West continue to believe in some kind of deity, regardless of their actual religious observance. And believing in God by itself challenges the state's omniscience and its status. Again, religion stands as a potential rival for the individual's allegiance. And it has this pesky tendency to resurface, no matter how much authoritarian governments try to suppress it. Take a look at Russia, for example. Now, of course, beyond just family and faith, there are infinite number of non-state institutions that offer communities for almost any kind of conceivable interest. And all of them, from business to social to civic organizations, serve this civilizing function, again, of organizing people without state power. And I'd like to make an important point that I think is often lost in the debate about a more libertarian society or even an ANCAP society. I think it's actually reasonable to believe that a more libertarian society would be less libertine and actually more culturally conservative, for the simple reason that as the state shrinks in importance and power, all of these long suppressed institutions of civil society reemerge and grow in importance and power. And in a more libertarian society, of course, it's harder to impose the cost of one's lifestyle choices onto others. If you rely on family or church or charity to help you, well, they may impose some conditions on that help. It's the story of mankind. Now, I assure you, I'm neither interested nor judgmental toward your personal beliefs or your religious beliefs or your lifestyle preferences, and neither was Murray Rothbard. And of course, libertarianism per se has nothing to say about how one lives. But it remains true that civil society should be celebrated by libertarians at every turn. To believe otherwise is to ignore what humans actually want and what humans actually do, which is create communities larger than themselves. And there's a word for people who don't believe in anything. Government, family, God, society, morality, civilization. And that word is nihilist, not libertarian. Not to say that a nihilist can't be a libertarian, but that there's a difference. The third point I'd like to make tonight is about politics and what libertarians ought to be thinking and doing politically. Again, there's this stubborn tendency amongst libertarians to advocate some sort of universal political arrangement. To the extent there's any political end for libertarians, it's allowing individuals to live as they see fit. The political goal is self-determination. And we get this by reducing the size and the scope and the power of government wherever we might be. But the idea of universal libertarian principles has somehow become mixed up with the idea of universal libertarian politics. And I think because of this, what most of us think of as live and let live libertarianism has been replaced by a doctrine of universal libertarian thought, oftentimes coupled or imposed, superimposed, with a cultural element. And because of this, again, libertarians often fall into a trap of sounding an awful lot like conservatives and progressives in the sense that they imagine themselves qualified to dictate how political arrangements ought to be made anywhere on the globe. But what's libertarian about telling other countries what to do? Shouldn't our political goal be radical self-determination, not universal values? It's bad enough when we turn on TV in the United States on Fox News, let's say, and we hear neoconservatives talking about what's best for Syria or Iraq or Korea or Russia, always sort of looking down their noses from their usually safe and well-paid and comfy Western perches, I might add. So this is intolerable. But it's even worse when you hear it from libertarians at Reason Magazine or someplace like that. I think it's not just a political, but it's also a tactical mistake. Now, when we talk about the universalist doctrine, it goes hand in hand with globalism, very hard to decouple. And it goes something like this. It says, well, democratic voting is the sacred political right today in the post-monarchical world. And when we have democratic voting, what this results in is social democracies with robust safety nets and regulated capitalism, legal protection for women and minorities, widely agreed upon norms regarding social issues. And these Western conceptions of civil rights now apply everywhere and anywhere. And with technology, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to bridge the divide and these old boundaries of nation states. There's slightly different flavors of universalist thought. The left liberals tend to emphasize sort of a supranational government, this administrative state. We might call it one world government, for lack of a better term. NGOs are part of this matrix. And conservatives tend to focus more on globally managed trade schemes and militarism, exporting democracy. That's a universalist doctrine from my perspective. But what brings them together is that both sides spent the 20th century insisting that their preferred political arrangements are applicable everywhere and inevitable everywhere, what's more. I would argue that this narrative actually does libertarians no favors. Because I think universalism might provide the philosophical underpinning for globalism, but globalism is not liberty. If anything, globalism threatens to create whole new levels of government, and globalism is not natural law. In fact, it's oftentimes at odds with human nature and real human diversity, I would argue. Because it turns out that when you talk to 7.5 billion different people around the world, there's very few things that are actually universally agreed upon. Not quite so many as we imagine. Not governance, not rights, not the role of religion, not immigration, not capitalism, not neoliberalism. We have a hard enough time winning respect for individual rights and property rights here in the West, where we have this strong hundreds and hundreds of years of common law tradition. So libertarians, for some inexorable reason, are busy promoting universalism, even as the world wants to move in the other direction. What do Trump and Brexit represent, if not a serious roadblock and a serious response to this doctrine of globalist inevitability? Nationalism's on the rise throughout Europe. For the first time in decades, the EU's been forced to defend itself. We have secession and breakaway movements in places like Scotland, in Catalonia, in Andalusia, in happily now in California. Federalism and states' rights are all of a sudden popular once again with our progressive friends. The world desperately wants to turn its back on Washington and Brussels and the EU and the UN and the IMF and all of these globalist institutions. I really think that average people have smelled a rat, and we ought to seize on this. It turns out that Mecca is not Paris, an Irishman is not an Aboriginal, a Buddhist is not a Rastafarian, a soccer mom is not a Russian mobster. Is it our goal to convince each and every one of them, or at least a 50% electorate of them around the world, to become thoroughgoing Rothbardians? Should libertarians care about gay marriage in Saudi Arabia, or insist that the same border arrangements that exist in Brownsville, Texas, ought to exist between France and Monaco? Should we spend our time advocating Texas-style open carry laws for Parisians to avoid the next Bataclan event? Maybe. But would our time be better spent making the case for political decentralization, secession, and subsidiarity? In other words, should we let Malta be Maltese? Because Ludwig von Mises rejected universalism, and he saw self-determination as the highest political end for liberty-minded people. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with his famous line about if it were possible, bringing self-determination down to the individual level. And Murray Rothbard, in one of the last things he ever wrote right before he died, made the case for organic nations breaking away from political borders in his great article entitled Nations by Consent. So in other words, self-determination is the ultimate political goal, not imposing some idea of cosmopolitan libertarianism on the rest of the world. It is the path to liberty, however imperfect. A world of 7.5 billion self-governing individuals might be our ideal, but short of that, in the real world today, we should prefer the Liechtensteins to the Germanys, the Luxembourgs to the Englands. We should prefer states' rights to federalization and control by DC in the US. We should cheer for the breakup of the EU. We should support some of these breakaway and secession movements I mentioned earlier in places like Catalonia and Scotland. We should always favor local control over faraway legislatures and administrative bodies. We should thus reject multilateral trade deals. We should, in sum, prefer small to large when it comes to government. Political decentralization, succession, subsidiary, nullification, these are the mechanisms available to us to move us closer to our political goals. Insisting on universal political arrangements is a huge tactical mistake for libertarians. It's precisely because we don't know what's best for people all around the world that we're libertarians in the first place. So I'll end with this, and then hopefully we have a few minutes for some questions from the audience. I had an email exchange a week or two ago with the blogger Bionic Mosquito. If any of you are not reading Bionic Mosquito, you ought to be. It's one of my favorite blogs, something I check out every day. And I asked Bionic Mosquito, I'm not going to say he or she because I don't know. I asked Bionic Mosquito the same hypothetical question I have for you. What would you, everyone in this room here and in Malta tonight, what would you fight for? And I think the answer to this question tells us a lot about what libertarians ought to care about. And by this, I mean, what would you physically fight for? Where doing so could mean serious injury or death, getting killed, or arrest and imprisonment, and the loss of your home, your money, your possessions? That's a good question. I'm sure all of us would fight for our physical persons if we were attacked on the street. We'd fight for our family's physical persons if they were attacked. We'd probably fight for our close friends and extended family too. And we might even fight for our neighbors if they were physically attacked. And in fact, we'd probably like to think, most of us, that we would defend a total stranger physically in some instances if you saw an older person being robbed or beaten up. We'd like to think that we'd intervene physically and risk harm. And if we expand this out a little bit, you know, you might fight for your town or your community if it was physically attacked or invaded by some kind of outside force. Even if you didn't personally know all the people in your town and community, you might band together for that. And to an extent, we might fight for our property too, not just our bodies, maybe not as fiercely. We'd certainly fight to protect our homes, but that's because we care about the people inside. How about our cars? Would you physically mix it up with a car thief who is driving away with your car, assuming he was armed? Or would you just let him go and not risk death or injury to save your car? How about your wallet? How about if somebody stuck a gun in your face and asked for your wallet? How about somebody stealing 40% of your income every 2 weeks, as many governments do? Would you take up arms to prevent this? I mean, we can look around and say that clearly. We would look around and say, clearly everyone in Malta is a courageous badass based on that. But now is where things get ugly. I'm going to say we probably wouldn't physically fight for Bitcoin or net neutrality or a capital gains tax cut. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that. But how about an abstraction? Would you fight for an abstraction like your country or freedom or your religion? This is where things get a little more tenuous. Now, many people, I don't want to disparage anyone, lots of people have fought for abstractions. But it's interesting, if you ask soldiers who've been in combat situations about what they fought for in the heat of an actual battle, they'll oftentimes tell you that they were fighting for the protection of their immediate mates in the actual unit. They were fighting to protect the men in their units and to fulfill some sort of personal sense of duty. That they would have felt terrible if everyone during World War II had gone off to war and they hadn't, or if their friends and family were being put in danger and they weren't. So, in other words, blood and soil and God and nation still matter to people. And I think libertarians ignore this at the risk of irrelevance. Thank you very much.
All right. So there's Jeff Dice's speech. Obviously, common sense. What does he do in the speech? He reaffirms libertarian principles by summarizing Rothbard's views. He says these are universal values and rights that we believe in. He says, however, we live in a world in which there's very little agreement, surprisingly little agreement, on very, very important things. So whatever our long-term ideological goals may be, our short-term political goals are simply going to have to be more modest than our long-term ideological goals, right? I mean, in other words, transgender rights in Saudi Arabia is probably not your first thing you're going to go for in this world. Or, you know, handing out, here's something one of his critics does, by the way, handing out U.S. constitutions in Iraq, you know, talk about dumb. I mean, first of all, you've got a totally artificial country. You have different groups that are simply going to use their electoral strength to oppress other groups. And then you hand them a document that has accomplished precisely that in this country. Anyway, so he gives this overview. He says, in the short run, maybe decentralization is an easier sell. And decentralization is moving in the direction we want to go, because ultimately we would decentralize down to the last individual. And so let's do that. Let's say, obviously, we prefer individual countries to the EU. And obviously, we prefer small countries to large countries. And we prefer small units within the large countries to the large countries, and small units within the small countries to the small countries, and on and on and on. Okay, again, fairly uncontroversial, I think, decentralism. All right, now I'm going to tell you what happened. There are people in the libertarian movement with left-wing sympathies who are calling this, I am not kidding you, you heard the speech for yourself, they're calling this a Nazi speech. I am not. You think, Woods, you're exaggerating. Nobody is that thick, right? And by the way, they're not that thick. I do want to emphasize, when I criticize Steve Horwitz, okay, he might not be a universal genius, but he's not an absolute idiot either. So he doesn't actually think this is a Nazi speech. That is impossible. I consider that an impossibility, because you and I just listened to that speech. So we know that's impossible that he could think that. Instead, what they're doing is what leftists do to anybody who dissents, is to come up with a name for them, a word that is toxic in our society, and use that to destroy those people and to virtue signal to the media and to the left. Look, I'm a good guy. I'm not like those terrible extremists over there. Now, by the way, that's not going to save you, because as soon as you turn around and say you're against Obamacare, they think you're a baby murderer. So, I mean, you know, what they think they're going to get out of this, I don't know. It certainly has never gotten any interest from the mainstream media in them. And the left, where are the major left-wing organizations that have in any way even acknowledged the existence of these people? So their strategy, as usual, gets them nowhere. Anyway, this is very much in line with a book that came out some years ago. You can find it on Amazon, called Ron Paul, America's Most Dangerous Nazi. Now, the word Nazi, of course, is being thrown around constantly these days by people on the left, right? We all are familiar with this. Nazi's the new thing. So racist isn't nearly toxic enough anymore, because the word racism has been applied to basically everybody. If you're against Obamacare, you're racist. So, you know, Steve Horwitz could... By the way, Steve Horwitz is a professor at Ball State University. So I'm just going to name him. Why not? Right? No point in dancing around this. I have a chapter in my book, Real Dissent, about some PC hectoring he did to Julie Borowski. I didn't mention his name. I just couldn't be bothered. You know, who wants to get into a fight with this guy? Anyway, America's Most Dangerous Nazi, Ron Paul. And when I saw that book years ago, I thought, what kind of a raving hysteric would write a book like that? Well, basically, Horwitz is more or less implying that the most recent, the last chief of staff Ron Paul had, who was Jeff Deist, who's the president of the Mises Institute, probably has some kind of, at the very least, may have fascist sympathies. That certainly this speech was an outright admission of fascism. And then his followers just came right out and said, neo-Nazi, Nazi, Nazi, Nazi. So in other words, they're acting exactly like Rachel Maddow followers. And I honestly thought that was so dumb, this use of Nazi, or white supremacist, by the way, is the new thing on the left, because racist doesn't work anymore. So now everybody's a white supremacist. So again, if you don't favor Obamacare, you're a white supremacist. So Steve's as much a white supremacist, so-called, as anybody by that metric. So, but he wants to try and throw the terms around so that he can show himself to be a good guy, even if it means trying to wreck the reputations of obviously normal, decent people. Again, you heard the speech, right? I played the whole thing for you. There's nothing else. There's nothing else in it. That decentralist speech is supposed to be a Nazi speech. So that critique of the speech follows in the tradition of this book, Ron Paul, America's Most Dangerous Nazi. So, I mean, for Ron Paul's chief of staff to be suspected of fascism, well, then you'd have to suspect Ron Paul of fascism. And now you really, really are in the lunatic, wacko, I have an IQ of 57 department. But again, I don't think Steve Horwitz has an IQ of 57. Now, I don't think he has a genius IQ. See, no evidence of that. So then what else? How else could you explain? Does he actually think Nazis are somehow taking over here? I mean, he really nobody thinks that. It's an attempt to damage the Mises Institute. So as any non-hysteric can see, Jeff is about the farthest possible thing from a Nazi that it is conceivable to be. So let's say Jeff is anti-war. I don't think the Nazis were really known for that, right? He's anti-imperialist. Again, I'm thinking that's not going over super-duper well with the Nazis. He's pro-free market. Well, the Mises Institute makes available a book by Gunter Riemann called The Vampire Economy, showing what the economy was like under Nazi Germany, and it was not really what you and I would want. So pro-market, not really Nazi. Decentralist, not really Nazi. See, here's the thing. The Nazis were for centralization, and Jeff's speech is calling for decentralization. So it's kind of like the opposite sort of thing. And Jeff has no reverence for the military whatsoever, and that's almost, I don't know, half of fascist ideology. Jeff believes that rights are prior to the state. Not that the state is everything, not that the state comes first, not that the individual has to subordinate himself to the common good or any of that that you hear from fascism. So that's about the farthest possible thing from a Nazi it is conceivable that someone could be. So a normal person does not go around screaming Nazi in this situation. That is not how a normal person behaves. Now, about Steve, just so you know where he's coming from, this in itself is not meant to disparage him. It's just to be informative. Horwitz has always been one of these anti-Ron Paul libertarians. So it's a shame we don't have phone booths anymore, or Steve and his fellow I don't like Ron Paul libertarians could hold their convention inside one. It's the whole, Ron Paul is not as cosmopolitan as I am. And, he's not as cool as Mises. And by the way, let me just say something about that. The accusation here is that Jeff is a backward reactionary. And if only he could take direction from the cosmopolitan Mises. Well, look, if you read Mises' views on pretty much anything, they sound like the views of a gentleman of old Vienna. So if you listen to his views on homosexuality or abortion or feminism, they don't sound like Hillary Clinton. And in fact, Mises was on the editorial advisory board of the magazine of the John Birch Society. Now, could you imagine if there were somebody at the Mises Institute who matched that description? We would never hear the end of it. Never. Anything else the person done in his life would be absolutely forgotten. And we would focus entirely on this. And yet not a word. I wouldn't surprise me if Horwitz didn't even know this about Mises. So anyway, Steve says he's not too impressed with Ron Paul. And he believes that his significance for libertarianism has been exaggerated. So when millions of people suddenly became interested in libertarianism, that was some kind of coincidence chronologically. Then Murray Rothbard is not really a good economist. Now, that's not uncommon in the Koch orbit. Murray Rothbard, not a good economist. It'd be interesting to get Bob Murphy's opinion on that. Of course, Mises very much disagreed with that. I mean, Mises could not have been more complimentary toward Rothbard's work. So, but anyway, I'm not saying you have to like Murray Rothbard to be a member in good standing of the human race, although it helps. But I just want to tell you who this person is and where he's coming from. Now, supposedly, one of the key indicators that this was a Nazi speech involves the use of the words blood and soil, because this is said to be a Nazi slogan. In fact, I was in a fruitless Facebook argument with insane lunatics over this, and one person said, well, look, Woods, if you heard somebody on the left using the expression, if you want to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs, you'd be all over the person. And I thought, what are you talking about? Everybody uses that expression. What are you talking? It must be fun to be around you all the time, walking on eggshells, tiptoeing around, making sure I don't say the wrong thing. Well, it's pretty obvious what's meant here. What's meant here? I mean, let's go with our listening comprehension here. What's meant here is that there are people, probably a majority of mankind, for whom place and kin still matter. And that maybe we ought to take this into account in what we're doing. Now, it doesn't mean we have to agree with everybody in the world, but it means we have to understand where they are. Isn't that what we're constantly being told about transgender folks or whatever? You got to figure out where they are and talk to them from there. So that only works on one side, apparently. Also, Jeff is not saying, I have a program to restore blood and soil. Duh. He's not being prescriptive. He's being descriptive about the state of the world. Also, the phrase actually more or less, or at least in part, originates with Oswald Spengler, who was reasonably well known as an opponent of Hitler. His book, The Hour of Decision, was suppressed by the Nazis. But even before that, the German Romantics used it. See, the problem is when you get all your knowledge from Wikipedia entries, major gaps tend to exist in your knowledge. Now, if you're trying to bring, good heavens, anti-Semitism into this, you have to be kidding me. The whole Mises University program that we just had, which is the Mises Institute's week-long instructional seminar, was anti-Nazi through the whole thing. Every single principle of it is anti-Nazi. Every single principle of it is anti-fascist. You couldn't possibly be more anti-fascist than these principles. In fact, the anti-Semites refer to Lou as Jew Rockwell. And the reason for that is that who's he surrounded by? Bert Blumer, David Gordon, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard. He's Jew Rockwell. That was the slur that they used for Lou. And David Gordon, who is every bit as Jewish as Steve Horwitz is, was telling me the other day about, of course, the crazy, you know, emotional hypochondria of the whole thing. And he said, what would it even mean to say this was meant to be a so-called dog whistle to Nazis? First of all, it's not a very good fundraising appeal. I highly doubt that Nazis, wherever they are doing super well economically. It's not a very good fundraising mechanism, even if you wanted to do that, even if there weren't any moral problem with doing it. But he says, what would it even mean? I mean, you go to the Mises Institute website, and what do we promote? Austrian economics and libertarianism. So if we were whistling to somebody, what would we then do with them once they came over? Teach them libertarianism? So in other words, David asks the common sense question. And by the way, there are people who have developed, I mean, Steve's one of them, Tom Palmer's one of them, David Bowes at Cato, who's just a ridiculous clownish figure. They're all three who spread these the black legend about the Mises Institute. So you have this sense that the Mises Institute must be up to all kinds of sinister things. But then you actually visit the website, which a fair-minded person would do. What do you find there? Libertarianism and Austrian economics. So at our instructional event last week, we covered the historical setting of the Austrian School of Economics, the relationship, the interplay between subjective value and market prices, economic method as the Austrians carry it out, the division of labor, money, capital theory, entrepreneurship. Judge Napolitano is there for the week every year, says it's his favorite week of the year, his favorite place to be. So, you know, go ahead and say what you want to say about the judge now. Might as well. You're going to have to if you're going to be consistent. The economic calculation debate. Talked about fractional reserve banking, war, which we're against. Duh. Talked about monopoly and competition. Go down the list. Hayek and Keynes, Hayek and Friedman, the minimum wage, the relationship between theory and history, the time preference theory of interest, the economics of Bitcoin, the curse of economic nationalism. See, again, going to be hard to square that. In fact, David Gordon twice reviewed Mises' views of the Nazis and his treatment of the Nazis as a historical topic. So, again, none of this, it doesn't make sense to say what they're saying. And I realize that I'm swatting a fly with a herd of elephants, but this is actually happening out there. There are people, again, I don't want to say there are people at the intellectual level of Steve Horwitz. Again, he's no genius, but he's literate. I mean, he can read a book. He knows that what he's saying about the Mises Institute is not even remotely true. Just go to the website. Look at the scholars conference that the Mises Institute has every year. Look at the scholars from all over the world who assemble to give technical economic papers on economics. That's what happens at the Mises Institute, as you can see with three or four clicks of the mouse. Meanwhile, somebody like David Bowes can tweet out a disparaging remark about Liberty University. He was critical of an un-PC student and said, well, you know, hey, he's at Liberty University. What do you expect? And that just goes. That just happens. No, of course we can say that because we're cosmopolitan sophisticates. So we can look down our noses at Liberty University. Well, that's kind of the spirit of what Jeff's talking about, is that maybe, you know, don't do that. What's the point of that? And in fact, by the way, the Koch brothers have no problem giving money to Liberty University and programs there. So take it up with them, you coward, who, of course, would never do that. But that just passes. This is the same David Bowes who, when Bill Weld was named to be the VP candidate for the LP, was so excited because, like, 20 years earlier, Bill Weld had written a blurb for the back cover of his book. I mean, that's the level of pathetic we're talking about. He tweeted that out. Look at this. The LP VP wrote a blurb for my book. Now, the rest of us are horrified that Bill Weld is being chosen, and we're horrified by his foreign policy views and a whole bunch of other things, which just don't seem to interest these folks at all, right? What's his view on gay marriage? And that is all we need to know. So the hilarious thing about this to me is that on the one hand, we have these lefty folks who want a virtue signal to the media and make clear that everybody understands that they're completely harmless. They're not really going to question much of anything except, you know, economic policy probably ought to be a little different from how it is now. But they're going to make clear that anybody with dissenting opinions, they'll help police it. They'll help the New York Times police that. And I can give you many examples of that. But anyway, they're going to do that. And yet, on the other hand, you have me. I'm supposed to be this stodgy old right-wing libertarian. And yet when push comes to shove and it's time for them to endorse political candidates, they endorse stuffed shirts like Gary Johnson, and I endorse radicals. I mean, it's always the case. I'm the one always endorsing the radical libertarian, wherever the person is. I'm the one endorsing that person. And these so-called chic cosmopolitan people are the ones tut-tutting me about being respectable and, you know, we got to put a good face out there, so we have to be respectable. Unbelievable. Now, there are reasons for this. There are reasons for this hostility. I'm not going to dignify them by claiming that they're really up at night, that Steve Horwitz is really up at night worrying about the un-PC Mises Institute, which is basically just a pro-peace, pro-market, anti-state organization, that he's worried that somebody may utter an un-PC thought from time to time. I really don't think anybody, even an emotional hypochondriac, is really that worried about that. They have their reasons for being opposed to the Mises Institute, the same way the Koch brothers had their reasons for being opposed to Ron Paul. Ron Paul, by the way, enraged and annoyed them. Because here he was, and we have this on good authority, as Tom DiLorenzo said in an earlier episode, that here they've been donating hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars, for all I know, to different think tanks, and they've basically gotten nowhere. Where's that gotten us? How are we a freer society because of that? It's gotten us nowhere. Meanwhile, Ron Paul just shows up, and millions of young people flock to him. So likewise, I think about some of the people who are critical here. I don't think anybody would walk across the street to see any of them. And I have a feeling it must irk them that people who are not as supposedly suave and debonair as they are somehow seem to, and with not one billionth the budget, nevertheless attract vastly disproportionate support. I mean, during the Ron Paul campaign, how many people came up to Ron Paul and said, you know, I was really influenced by the Cato Institute? Basically nobody. Nobody. Now, I don't know if that annoys them or what it is. I've had a lot of success with no billionaire donor. And I just say what I want to say. And I've had basically all the prominent libertarians on my show, and it's been very friendly. I have a cruise. I have all these great things going on. I don't know. Maybe that irks them. I don't know. The bottom line is they listened to the speech I just played for you in its entirety. I played you the whole thing. I didn't secretly remove a sentence saying, oh, by the way, disregard everything I'm saying and everything I've ever said, because this is secretly a speech for... I mean, come on, right? Yeah, an anti-war, pro-market, decentralist believer in natural rights has some kind of kinship with the so-called far right or fascism. How could that be? That would be to deny every single one of those principles. And then you say, but Woods... aren't there people out there who are libertarians who indeed have sympathy for fascism? Well, if there are, then they have temporarily suspended their libertarianism. Because how can you, or they don't understand what fascism is. Because how could those principles possibly be compatible? Obviously, they're not. So what we've had here is a ridiculous, over-the-top virtue signaling. Oh, we are so much more pure than these folks at the Mises Institute. The Mises Institute is one of the great benefactors of all mankind, as you can see from the enormous collection of books they have in the libertarian tradition, of books they have in the Austrian School of Economics, going back to the very beginning, that you can read for free. And most of them, or at least a good bunch of them, are in audiobook format. That's also been made available to you for free. They release articles every day for free. They have entire print runs of academic journals available for free, entire courses for free. Robert Higgs has an excellent course on the growth of government, for example. Or Paul Cantor, who studied under Mises at his seminar, has an excellent course on literature and popular culture. You can find all these things there. Again, some of the top scholars in the world have come and spoken or delivered courses at the Mises Institute. You can discover this all for yourself at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. But I'm going to tell you what I personally am going to do right now. I'm about to go donate to the Mises Institute, and I'm going to ask you, I'm approaching 1,000 episodes of this show. I have a very big audience, and I'm extremely grateful for it. And I don't ask a whole lot. Yeah, you know, if you want to support the show, that's great, and I appreciate that. But you don't have to. You don't have to. You can just keep listening. But I'm going to ask you as a favor to me, if you've gotten anything out of any of these episodes, and go to tomwoods.com/episodes, by the way, to look at the diversity of topics we've covered, it's really astonishing. If you've gotten anything out of these episodes, I am going to ask a favor of you, and that is, I want you to make a donation to the Mises Institute right now. Even if it's just $5, I want you to go over to mises.org/donate, because I'm about to donate $1,000, and if Steve Horwitz smears the Mises Institute again in this calendar year 2017, forward it to me. Send it to me at tom@tomwoods.com. I don't use that email address very much, so even if spammers do clog it, it doesn't really matter to me. So tom@tomwoods.com. I can't necessarily get back to you, but forward it to me there, and every time he does that, I'm going to do another fundraising appeal. I'm going to donate another $1,000, up to $10,000 in this calendar year. So every time he smears the Mises Institute, we're going to raise more money. So I need you to do this. The Mises Institute, without the Mises Institute, there wouldn't be a Tom Woods show. There wouldn't have been Meltdown, which was my New York Times bestseller about the financial crisis. I've done an awful lot. Whatever else you want to say about me, I haven't been a lazy bum. I've done an awful lot. I've made hundreds and hundreds of homeschool videos teaching young people about history, economics, and government. What have these people done? Have they done that? Have they done anything anywhere in the ballpark of that? They spend their time hectoring productive people like me, basically, instead of actually getting out there and doing something. And no, writing 3 books that cost $120 each does not count. I am urging you, in response to this outrageous, ridiculous PC attack. I mean, how do these people sound any different from Rachel Maddow supporters? You actually shout Nazi at ideas that are obviously the exact opposite of the Nazis. And by the way, this whole thing about, oh, they're secretly trying to appeal to the alt-right. Well, from what I've seen, the alt-right does not really favor decentralization, which is why some of them feel mixed about even the Confederate issue, because they say, well, we'd rather just have one big white country instead of having this secession. I've heard some of them say they favor the EU, because maybe that's the beginning of a unified white presence politically in the world. I don't see the compatibility there. If Jeff is saying what I want are tiny little units, this is boring to a fascist. A fascist is a romantic, and a romantic thinks beyond just the mundane existence of day-to-day life, the mundane day-to-day activities of your local neighborhood or whatever. What is that? We want historical greatness, and that means bigness, it means ambition, it may mean territorial expansion. In other words, the exact opposite of what Jeff is saying, as you heard for yourself in the speech. So here we are. On the one hand, you have Ron Paul, America's most dangerous Nazi. You have people who believe that. On the other hand, you have the relatively small band of people at the Mises Institute who are up against the whole world, and the great many of us who love and support them. Well, if you're reading their articles, you're enjoying their output, now's the time. Tell them thank you. Thank you for taking the slings and arrows of pygmies. Thank you for supplying me with all this material for free. And thank you for not backing down, not being pathetic and apologizing for nothing in the face of juvenile attacks by virtue signalers. So head over to Mises.org/donate. I'll put that on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/966, and join me in this effort. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.